history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you, maybe even living right next door to you. And when we take the time to listen to their stories, it sure changes our perspective. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the journey, we sure are educated, we're entertained, and so often even inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This week is when our country sets aside a day to give thanks. But do we really know how much we have to be thankful for? Do we really appreciate the freedom that over a million Americans have died to preserve, that countless others have bled for, have carried physical and emotional scars for decades in order to preserve? One group of people that really gets it when it comes to freedom, those who have had to live in the absence of freedom. Over the years, I've had the privilege to sit down with dozens of ex-prisoners of war, including quite a few who have shared their stories here on Hometown Heroes. In fact, if you were to peruse the podcast at hometownheroesradio.com, you'd find at least 37 ex-prisoners of war from 10 different states. Every story is unique, but there's one thing that those men all have in common. Whether they were in captivity for a month or maybe even the entire war, once they were liberated, they never took their freedom for granted again. And really, why should we? My hope today is that as we prepare for Thanksgiving this week, we would arrive at an even deeper level of gratitude by listening to some of these ex-POWs, a little bit of what they went through, and just how much our flag, our country, and our freedom means to them. We'll start with Dean Whitaker of Las Vegas, Nevada, whose first mission as a teenage bombardier with the 398th Bomb Group came just after D-Day in 1944.
I guess Eisenhower requested Air Force help, so we went in at a low altitude. We usually flew at about 28,000 feet. On this mission, I think it was at 5,000 or so feet. And every gun German had, it was shooting at us. I could see the flashes from the ground of them shooting at us, and we knew exactly when we flew over enemy lines when all this flashing started. And we were getting hit once in a while. I could smell it every time we got hit, the burning of the material against the aluminum. And this happened quite a bit. We dropped our bombs and turned around, and the plane next to us got hit real bad, and it exploded, and nobody got out of that. And it was quite a sight. It lasted me quite a while. But on the way back, we went over the lines. We got hit again. The instrument panel in the plane, and the nose got shot out, and the hydraulic line from the controls is red, and we had this red come all over us, and the navigator that was up with me thought he was shot. He saw, oh my gosh, this red is coming out of my chest. Well, he rubbed it and found out that it was hydraulic fluid, so he felt great. But in the meantime, when the nose got shot out, I had a face full of plexiglass, and I could hardly see. And it was burning really bad. So we got back to the base, and they took me to the base hospital, cleaned my eyes out. And in the following few days, my eyes were swollen shut. And so I was off flying duty for 2 weeks. And as soon as they healed, I could see again, I was back. I think I missed just one mission because of that. It was a terrible situation because the plane had gotten hot pretty bad. One engine was out and one engine was feathering, and we weren't making much headway. And I thought, boy, we'll be lucky to get back to base. But you know, the Lord is with me, and that really helped.
Amen to that. And I think through the rest of your story, we're going to see that as well. I have to ask you, if you had a nearly fatal crash before you ever flew a mission, and then you got hit in the eyes and couldn't see after your first mission, Were you a little hesitant to go on more missions after that?
You know, being an 18-year-old kid, you really are kind of fearless. You think, well, somebody's got to make it out of this, and I'm going to be the one. And you have that attitude that it's kind of a devil-may-care attitude, and you don't scare that easy. We would always meet under our plane before a mission, and everybody say a little silent prayer, and this helped.
He eventually would get the Purple Heart 60 years later, but little did Dean know at the time that darker days were ahead. On November 2, 1944, the target would be the heavily defended synthetic oil plant in Merseburg, Germany. It was his 20th mission, and it would prove to be his last.
When I looked ahead and saw the flak, which is the black explosion of 88-millimeter shells going off, I thought, Mike, we're going to be lucky to get through this. And we got through it fine. We were hit a few times. I could tell when you were hit that we could smell the burning hot flak metal going through the ship. And we got out of that fine. And as soon as we were out of that, the Luftwaffe attacked us. The first attack, they always attack from the tail because their 20-millimeter cannon would go further than our 50-caliber machine gun. And so the tail gunner was really busy on that first mission. And I think he shot down one of the planes. One of the fellows said, you got one, over the intercom. And so on the second attack, we were hit really bad. The tail gunner was shot bad. And the waist gunner went back to check on him, and he did. He said he's dead. By that time, we were hit real bad, and the plane was out of control. The pilot gave the word to bail out, and me being the navigator, right by the nose escape hatch, I was the first one out. On the way, before I could go out, I had to release. I wore what they called a flak suit, armor vest, and I couldn't. There's an escape tag on that that you pull, and it's supposed to be released. Well, it didn't release, and I was fighting that, trying to get that off, and I said, man, I got to get out of here. And, you know, I had a voice kind of. My father had passed away. About 8 months before I went in the service, and I thought I heard his voice say, you get out of there now. So I did. I wanted to jump out. I said, I can't wait any longer. I jumped out of the escape hatch of the nose. And as soon as I hit the slipstream, it tore the flak suit off, but my parachute was only fastened on one side because I couldn't fasten the other side when the flak suit was on. So here I was fighting all the way down, trying to fasten the other side. And at 28,000 feet, you have no strength. You're just ready to pass out. And so I started entering some clouds at 3,000 feet. And I said, well, I better pull this now, whether it's fastened or not. And I pulled it, and I was floating down, and I could hear shots coming up at me. And the Germans were shooting at me as I was coming down.
And this was fire from their aircraft or from the ground?
That was from the ground. It was civilians in the ground were shooting. They all had guns. And then the odd thing about this, when I was, before I hit the ground, I could hear cheering. And I thought, who the heck is cheering in the middle of Germany? And I just about landed in a German prisoner of war camp that held English prisoners. And luckily, a guard from this camp come running out of the camp and made the civilians stop shooting me. They had their rifles already aimed at me, and so they stopped shooting, and the guard gathered me up and took me into this camp, and the English prisoners of war gave us tea and crumpets. It was really something. Four members of my crew were not that lucky. They landed too far away for this soldier to save them, and they were killed by the German civilians, and they later paid for it when the GIs came in, and they had a trial, and I have the names of all the soldiers that did that, and I think they were executed for doing that.
Well, that's understandable, and I'm just struck. We talk about close calls, and you've already described a couple close calls in the air, But here, out of just the sheer chance of the order in which you get out of the airplane and where you come down, you could have been killed by angry German civilians. Instead, you landed where you were safe.
It was really safe. Then I did notice when I got down that my parachute was fastened on both sides. And I don't know. I had some help there.
So you have no idea how that other side got fastened?
No. It was done.
Yes, it was. But now you're a prisoner, and after more than a month at Stalag Luft 3 in what is now Poland, they take you out, march you guys 10 days through the snow in the dead of winter, and after that long march, they stick you in boxcars designed for 40 men or 8 horses, but the Germans stuffed a whole lot more than that in there.
We got in these 48s, and they were so crowded you had to stand. There was no room to sit. There was a few guys who were pretty sick, and we'd make room for them to lay down. One occasion, it's Christmas time, and somebody started singing Silent Night. The whole train caught on to that, and you could hear a trainload of GIs singing Silent Night.
Something tells me that each Christmas now, when you hear that song, you probably go back to that 40 and 8.
Yeah, that's true. It sure reminds you of that occasion, because it was really hard sleeping in those cars, standing up. And I think we were relieved 2 times to get out and go to the bathroom in those 2 days or 3 days on that train. I don't recall just exactly, but it was an ordeal.
So it was probably a relief when you arrived at your next destination, even though you were a prisoner there.
Yes, we crossed the Danube, I believe it was, and then this got little town of Moosburg. It wasn't a city, it was a town, and we marched through that town, and all the German civilians were hanging out of their window with a swastika. Later on, after we were liberated, we walked by that same town, and all the white flags were out.
That's a sharp contrast, and a very good one on the second half of that. So at this new prison camp, were the conditions the same? Were they worse? And had your morale been impacted at all by all this that you've been through?
No, it was worse. The facilities were bad. We had no place to sleep. They had put up some temporary tents. And the first night, we slept in an old barn that had so many leaks in it. And I tried to find a place to sleep that wasn't getting dripped on. Couldn't find it. Everything leaked. But the next day they took us into temporary tents, and this was so crowded. When you slept, you had to sleep on the floor, and everybody was sleeping on the floor, and there was no room. If you had to get up at night, you had to walk over all these bodies. Unluckily, I had dysentery at the time and had to get up a few times during the night. But this dysentery enabled me to go into sick call, which was a permanent barracks that was run by a pre-med student, an Air Force captain. So he treated me, and I'll tell you a little story about him now. On our liberation, the first day we saw this infantry spotter planes coming over, and knew they were spotting for the artillery. They sighted us and knew we were there. So I think there was 5,000 American officers in this camp. The next morning, we could hear the tanks. They were really making a lot of noise, rumbling. And every once in a while, they'd shoot some. The Germans was broken up into the Luftwaffe guards, who treated us decently, and SS troops that were guarding us. Two different type individuals. When they heard the tanks coming, the Luftwaffe soldiers wanted to surrender to us, and they started coming into our camp. There was a road leading to our camp from a cheese plant next to us, and the SS troops started shooting their own soldiers that were coming into our camp. And the road coming into the camp, you could see the bodies of a few of them, and they were shooting up our camp too. And I got into a slit trench we had built, trying to get protected from the shots being fired into our camp. And one of the shots missed me about 12 inches, I guess. It hit the reeds that were supporting this slit trench. As soon as the tanks saw the shooting from this tower, they shot it. And boy, that tire just blew to pieces by the tanks guns. All right, then that was in the morning. As soon as everything was cleared out, the tanks came into camp. I have a picture of the soldier, the infantryman, shooting the lock off of the gate to the camp. And behind him came the tanks. Were we ever glad to see them? Then I don't know what the time was, and then a little bit later after the tanks, General Patton came in with the tanks. I was in sick bay, which was in the first building, and I was standing at the stoop waiting to greet them. I didn't know he was coming, but he came over to the stoop, to the camp, to the door where I was, and asked me, he says, "How you doing, son?" I says, "Fine now that you're here, General." Well, he was there to see his son-in-law, the medical medic I was telling you about. It was his son-in-law. His son-in-law got hit by one of these stray bullets, but luckily it had gone through the building and it's pretty well spent. They did carry him out, but he was fine.
I look at your wall here in your home in Las Vegas, and you have a very well-preserved and document, the docket with German text and a picture of a young American POW with his fingerprint. How did you come to possess that paper from the German files that documented your captivity?
When the war is over, we could do pretty well what we want. Well, I went to the headquarters of the Luftwaffe there, and it was in all a mess. You know, they'd taken all the files and scattered them over. Well, I found this German ID on the floor, a picture of me. It was my ID, and I said, gee, I'm going to keep that. So I did. I still have it today. The writing is in German. I can't understand it, but the picture is me.
No doubt about it, and they spelled your name right. When you see that on your wall, and it's not too far from your Purple Heart or your Caterpillar Club for bailing out of an airplane, the wings that you wore, and a picture of your crew, but when you see that picture of you as a prisoner of war, what does it mean to you? Does it trigger something in your mind? Does it have a significance to you when you look at that?
Oh, yes, it sure does. It just reminds me how fortunate I was to escape that and to live a nice life afterwards.
So for the rest of us, how does that compare to the things we're grateful for this Thanksgiving week? You'll find links and photos connected to the veterans you hear today at hometownheroesradio.com. And up next, we'll go from Europe to the Pacific and hear from a man who survived the Bataan Death March. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, where this week, instead of listening to one veteran start to finish, as we typically do, we're hearing multiple voices underscoring a common theme of gratitude. This week, our nation celebrates Thanksgiving, but when it comes to our freedom, do we really realize how much we have to be thankful for? Those who endured years, months, or even just weeks as prisoners of war sure do have perspective on it, and they're coloring our perspective today. When it comes to the infamous Bataan Death March in April of 1942, there were more soldiers from New Mexico on the march than from any other state. One of them was a man named Julio Barella. And even before the march started, things had gotten pretty bleak for Julio. He and his fellow members of the 200th Coast Artillery in the Philippines were undersupplied, ill-equipped, and had no hope of reinforcements.
We don't surrender until we run out of everything. We were starving, eating weeds and stuff like that in order to survive. And there's where the death march started.
Now, when you started that march, you had no idea how long it was going to go. And you're already starving, right?
We started that death march pretty weak. We were pretty weak then because when we were fighting, we didn't have enough to eat. First thing, we were getting only 2 meals a day, and then they cut us to 1 meal a day. And then after that, we didn't have anything to eat. So,
what kept you going? How did you continue on? Because I'm sure a lot of guys were falling by the side and probably getting shot or bayoneted, and you were seeing guys fall left and right. What kept you going? How do you think you survived?
To survive? Well, we used to hunt. We used to eat weeds and stuff like that. Then a lot of them died with malaria, and a lot of them with diarrhea, according to what they eat, see. And part of them died in the death march, and then the other part died in concentration camp.
Did you ever think that you were going to die?
I thought I was going to die, but I just got to where I didn't care. It was just like this. See, I used to worry a lot about my folks, about my mother. I used to worry every day. And one day I said to myself, "Why, hell, I'm nothing but a doggone stupid. I'm not going to worry about them because they're better off than I am. They're not having as much trouble as I am having. And the other boys, they feel the same way. We got to where we forgot all about our folks and about the living life. Maybe we were just lucky because when they surrendered, a lot of them died of starvation. A lot of them, they didn't have anything to eat. They were weak, malaria, dysentery, and all that, a lot of disease. Well, we got to where we didn't care. We used to help the ones that couldn't walk. By the Japanese, the ones that couldn't walk, they shoot them. When a man lay down and he can't get up, why, they shoot him. So if they were punish you when you were in concentration camp, they punished me and they knocked me down. And then I have in mind that if I try to stand up and get up, I won't be killed. So, see, that's a lesson the hard way.
I'll say that's a great way to put it, learning the hard way indeed. And every survivor of the death march that I've interviewed over the years has told me really the same thing that you just did. No one knows exactly how many people died on the march. I've seen estimates of around 10,000 or so. And who knows how many died later because of what they went through on the march. But I know that you Americans helped each other, and you got a lot of help from the Filipinos, who, from what I've seen statistically, outnumbered Americans on the march about 7-1. But all of you were not only marching 61 miles through deep layers of dust, you really didn't have any kind of nourishment. How bad was it? How bad in terms of what you had to eat and drink?
They make us wait 3 days before they could start giving us a bowl of rice, just how much they can grab on a bowl of rice. And that's when the death march starts. They start walking without water. And then in concentration camps, we were there starving all the time that we were in prison camp. We never did get anything much to eat. And they were Filipinos. They would try to help us, give us food. They find out that Filipino tried to help POWs. They would shoot them, burn their kids, burn their homes. They act like they were not civilized. We never have a dream that we was going to survive. We didn't never thought we was going to make it.
Do you remember how much you weighed before?
I weighed about 145, 150. I never been very heavy. But when I was liberated, I weighed 83 pounds.
Your liberation. You survived the march to Camp O'Donnell. You'd been in another infamous camp at Cabanatuan. They took you over to Japan on a hell ship. And in late August of 1945, the atomic bombs had been dropped, the war was coming to an end, and finally your camp at Niigata, Japan, was liberated. What do you remember about that? What do you remember about tasting freedom again for the first time in more than 3.5 years?
We're very, very weak. Our mind was very weak, and our bodies very weak. We couldn't hardly do much work. Oh, we just... hope and pray that someday the war will be over. We were working in a foundry. They never gave us a day off, so we noticed that it was a surprise to us that the Japanese said that we were going to get 3 days off, that we have to stay in camp. So we were anxious to hear the Japanese commander telling us that we have surrendered. And the American officer asked the Japanese, what happened? Nothing. You people won the war. The war is over. Now you people take over tonight. What the Japanese told the American commander, you take care of your prisoners, not to go out because they're going to get killed, because the Japanese don't like the American prisoners, and they're going to get killed if they go out of the camp. So better stay in the camp, so we stay there, you know, until the next day. And then the next day, they go three planes, and they drop us leaflets saying that if we would clear the area, they will drop packages.
So they dropped some leaflets. They said, get out of the way. We don't want to kill you with the food we want to drop for you. And then you finally got to go outside of the walls of that camp. You'd been living in, I would imagine, and you've described what would be a bleak, seemingly hopeless world for so long, only praying that you'd make it out alive. So not to be too cliched, but did it feel like a dream come true or a prayer answered when you got to come home? What did that feel like?
We had plenty to eat. Every place we go, we just give us something to eat and stuff like that. And it was pretty hard to tell the whole story about it. And I don't know. And some people, the prisoners of war I have talked to, they feel the same way that I feel. They didn't want to talk about it. They got to where they didn't want to talk about it. That's funny. We do more talking now than we did before. We never did say anything because everywhere we go, we start asking us how many Japanese did we kill and all that. None.
Let me ask you this. How often do you think about the other prisoners of war who didn't get to come home? Do you ever think about that, about all the guys who died over there?
I dream more about them than I dream about my people, even today. Every day I remember about some of the prisoners.
Do you ever think that could have been you? Do you ever think about how you could have died there?
Yeah, surprises me that I made it. I sometimes don't even believe it. Being so long and I've getting old and all that, I sometimes don't believe it. I don't believe it. I went through all that.
It's hard for anyone to believe it. That was Julio Barella from New Mexico, survivor of the Bataan Death March. Again, links to all the full interviews with these ex-prisoners of war at hometownheroesradio.com. Now we're going to go back to the European theater with Leonard Cosby of Tulare, California.
He was in the 80th Infantry Division, got to Europe in late 1944, was captured Christmas Eve, actually, I guess the morning, Christmas Day of 1944, and was liberated in April of 45. Along the way, he lost a third of his body weight from 150 pounds to 98 with that wonderful POW diet of sawdust bread and turnip soup in Stalag 4B in Germany. I want to read for you something. You know, a lot of POWs save mementos from their time in camps. Mr. Cosby has a couple very unique souvenirs. One of them is a beautiful Christmas card. It says, Merry Christmas, 1944. And it was sent to his mother back in California. It says, Tuesday, December 5th, 1944, Northern France. Dearest Mother and John, hope this finds you all having a nice Christmas and not worrying about Lewis and myself. It's like the chaplain said the other day when he was talking to us, it is never so bad, but what, it can't be worse. If it is God's will that we come back, then we will be back. All that we can do is hope and pray to God to see us through the worst. I will close wishing you all a Merry, Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. With love, forever, Leonard. Boy, that's quite the statement that you made in there, huh? That it's never so bad, but what, it can't be worse. And if it is God's will that we come back, then we will be back.
And that is something that I think that you really depend on.
And you wrote this December 5th.
Right.
20 days later, You became a guest of the Gestapo, as they say. As you spent those 4+ months in captivity, is that something, that concept, that God would see you through this, something that you were able to hold on to help you get through that time?
I believe it was, yes.
How did that play out in the day-to-day? Because here you are, a 19-year-old kid, freezing your rear end off with nothing to eat. You're a captive at the hands of the Germans. How did you get through day-to-day? What were some of the things that you guys did in camp to keep your spirits up?
Well, we were busy out working on the streets, sweeping them and cleaning them up, and that took a lot of our time. Also, we would be visited by Germans who would drop in to see if we were all right and see if everything was okay. But other than that, that was about the extent of it.
And after experiencing life as a prisoner, seeing your freedom taken from you, to get back to a free America again and step foot on the good old USA, what did that feel like?
That was great, because I felt that I could get out and walk around and go where I wanted to go and do whatever I wanted to do without any hindrance and without any danger.
Do you think that your experience as a POW taught you things that you might not have learned otherwise? Did it change your perspective?
Yes, I think it did. And the fact that what it does take for you to survive on,
mm-hmm.
and anything and everything above that is a luxury. I am just grateful and thankful for whatever I have and everything that I have and for the good family that I have and the offspring.
Well, I don't know about you, but I'm thankful to have known people like Mr. Cosby and gotten a little taste of what they've gone through. It helps me see all the things that I so easily take for granted. Time for another break, but another prisoner of war's emotional story is sure to grab you when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting rvcountry.com. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Effler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. If you're an RVer, you've probably heard about the new line of Grand Design fifth wheels, travel trailers, and toy haulers. What sets Grand Design apart is the long list of premium standard features you'll find on the entire line. You'll also find the largest selection of Grand Design RVs at Paul Everett's RV Country. With 8 locations in 5 western states and online at rvcountry.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Effler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country. With 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Before I forget, I want to welcome another new affiliate to the Hometown Heroes family. Power Talk 1460 and 101 FM, covering a beautiful part of the Golden State, Monterey, Santa Cruz, and the city that gave us a World War II war correspondent turned legendary author named John Steinbeck. That would be Salinas, California. I look forward to meeting some more veterans in that neck of the woods, and it's always great to have another station step up and say, you know, our listeners sure should hear what these veterans have to say. We've been working on an attitude of gratitude today in light of Thanksgiving, and the next voice you'll hear certainly embodies that. I caught up with him in Bonita Springs, Florida, a P-47 pilot who was extremely fortunate to have survived being shot down over enemy territory. But then, like the first veteran you heard from today, Dean Whitaker, he was taken to Stalag Luft 3 in Zagon, which is now in Poland. This is the camp that served as inspiration for the classic film, The Great Escape. If you've never seen that one, pick it up. So one of the things that I asked Ray Maloney was, did you hear about escapes when you arrived at Stalag Luft 3?
In fact, I talked to some of the fellows who had escaped and were recaptured and weren't part of the 50 that were executed. 76 got out, and 3 made it to Sweden. So, but the Germans recaptured 73 of them and executed 50 of them. Mm-hmm. And so the other 20-some were put back in the camp, and I got to talk to a couple of them off and on. They were all mostly RAF guys, you know.
Well, and you would end up spending a lot of time with the RAF guys.
Yeah, I was in the compound with them, yeah. I was the only American in my room. They were all Englishmen.
What was life like in that POW camp on a day-to-day basis? What kinds of things did you do to pass the time, and what kind of kept you going?
First of all, you know, as I mentioned when we started talking, Paul, being a prisoner of war is a degrading, humiliating kind of experience, and it's not something that I'm proud of. It didn't take any skill or, you know, specialty to get captured. And because I didn't finish my tour, and a lot of my friends did, and a lot of my friends were killed, I always felt guilty about being, and I could tell from talking to other people in the camp, they have the same feeling, that it's a terrible guilt feeling that you're not helping at this point, you know. Even though your instructions are, when you are captured, you are still a military, you're still U.S. Army, and your responsibility is to do what you can to, you know, confuse, confound, and, you know, aggravate the enemy as much as you can.
That's probably my favorite line from that movie, The Great Escape. It's put so well by, I think, one of the British officers, the character in that film, where he says it's the sworn duty of every serviceman to escape, do everything you can to escape. So did you do any of those things?
Well, I was, you know, a junior. Here I am, a second lieutenant. Yeah. I'd just been shot down, and I was in a room with fellows that had been down since Tobruk, you know, 4 years before that, you know. So they had all the experience in the world. And I was a know-nothing, you know, an American. But you knew that they had learned over the months and years how to survive mentally and emotionally, you know, in a prison camp. And it helped me get through, you know. As you say, you've got this guilt feeling, and they would talk about it too, that, you know, we're here and we're not doing anything. But at the same time, I had heard stories about the Germans, at least the ones that ran the camps, were kind of single-minded, you know. And the British are delightful at deceiving, and, you know, what looks like something is not really it. You know, the British are great at this.
Uh-huh.
And they would, the story I used to get was that they would occasionally leave a plan for tunnels that didn't exist, you see. And they'd leave them somewhere where the German ferrets, we used to have guards come through with overalls on and screwdrivers and flashlights, and they were forever climbing under the barracks or in the attic, you know, something, trying to find what we're doing, you know, escape activities. They would just go in great glee when the Germans had found some plan for underground tunnels, you see. And then the Germans would bring in trucks and to ride around the outside to try to collapse any of the tunnels and drive big iron bars down into the ground, you know, to feel if they're going to hit the top of the tunnel. And the Brits would just sit there, you know, and giggle and watch all this, you know.
That's classic.
It was nothing, yeah. They knew how to survive, you know. Now, the food.
I've heard some stories now.
Yeah, right. The movies never describe, you know, never get into this. But there is an absolute eternal hunger, a yearning for food. You don't get enough food, and you're hungry. It's gnawing at you. The only thing that kept us alive was Red Cross parcels used to come through. Not all the time, but when they came through, the package was about 11 pounds of food, and it had like a can of corned beef and some biscuits and a chocolate bar, a couple of packs of cigarettes, powdered milk in a can, you know, things of this sort. And it was designed to keep one man alive for 1 week. But the whole time I was a POW, the most they ever got was half a carton a week. So two men to a carton per week. So we were starving, you know, slowly starving. I only know my own experience, although everybody was turning into a skeleton. But I was always a tall, skinny kid. And when I was shot down, I weighed 165. And when I was liberated and the Americans weighed me, I weighed 125. Mm-hmm. So I'd gone through 40 pounds in just 6 months.
Makes you wonder how much longer you could have survived.
Yeah, it's this gnawing, and it's 24 hours a day. When you sleep, you dream about food. And they had a little game, a torturous game, naming some dish or menu that we hadn't thought of before. You know, and somebody would say, I got another one, pineapple upside down cake. And I would say, oh.
Just dreaming of food.
Yeah,
huh?
Just dreaming of food. It was tough.
What do you think was the worst thing that you had to stomach just because it was some kind of sustenance?
Probably the what we call the blood sausage. It was, you know, like a thing about that round, and you got little cuts of the sausage, and it was foul meat, but at least it was some meat, some protein.
Did you ever fear that you would die there in the POW camp?
Not right in the camp, but as the Russians were advancing, and of course the Americans and the British were advancing, the rumors started to come that we were going to be evacuated and taken down into an Austrian redoubt where the Germans were going to hide out to the end. The scuttlebutt was we were going to be the bargaining chip. They were going to hold us to the last minute and then bargain us out in terms of more favorable surrenders.
Right.
You know, and of course, we had been evacuated once from Sagan when the Russians got the
night. Tell me about that. That must have been quite an interesting experience.
It was a snowstorm, you know. We had been following, you know, the Russians, and we knew they were getting closer and closer. And the night they put us on the road, the Raus came through the barracks, you know, Raus, 30 minutes, Raus, we're leaving 30 minutes. So you gathered up all whatever little, you know, things you had and prepared to march. And there was probably 6-8 inches snow on the ground. It was freezing and it was snowing. And as we were being marched out of the camp, we could hear machine gun fire. Now, I don't know whether it was Germans firing, but the rumor passed through the group was that's the Russian advance patrols. They're that close that on the east side of Sagan, you could hear the machine gun fire. And of course, we started marching west. And we went through, I think, 4 nights and 5 days marching. And it was that was the worst winter that they had had in 50 years in Germany.
Yeah.
And I read later, and I had heard some, you know, stories about it when we were doing this, how cold it was. But the average temperature, they were saying, for that march was 17 below zero. So it was freezing cold, you know.
And while all this is going on, your wife back home doesn't even know if you're dead or alive.
My mother and her got the notice Thanksgiving Day, and it was right around, give or take a day, around New Year's before they finally found that I was a POW.
So until then, the
first one you get is missing in action.
So they weren't sure you were alive until they got one that said
you
were POW.
Yeah, from Thanksgiving to New Year's.
But you didn't know if she knew.
Yeah, no, you don't know. And, and the whole time I was I never got a letter from anybody because they told me that it would take 6 months or better before you got your first letter. You know, I never got it.
So you're marching through the snow, trying to stay warm at night, waiting for a little more food. I'm sure your feet are freezing.
Oh, it was terrible. Yeah. Feet got wet And we were tired. You know, we had no stamina. You know, we couldn't do this. And in the back, everybody's mind was, don't go fast. Slow this down as far. We were hoping the Russians would overtake us.
Sure.
Know? So
yeah, better odds that way, huh?
And the POWs would stretch out for miles. It was, you know, thousands.
And eventually, you made it to Stalag 7A in Moosburg, Germany, where General Patton and your liberators would arrive in April of 1945.
I guess around noontime, the shooting seemed to stop, and it was quiet for a while, and then German flag came down, and we were all watching this, and an American flag, I can't even say it without, yeah.
You're overcome with emotion right now, remembering that.
And it went up, and it was upside down first time, came down, then it went up, and we all cheered.
Wow, yeah. I can't imagine what that felt like after everything you've been through, from the time that you got out of that airplane until then. I mean, that just had to be the most glorious thing you ever saw.
Yeah, it was. I'm sorry.
I think everyone understands the emotions that must be going through your heart right now.
Another one of my most emotional moments of my military career was we came into New York City, and we was, you know, as I said, the wounded came first, and then the POW. So we were very early in returning, and of course the country was still celebrating, you know, the fact that we had won. And as we're coming up the straits, you know, Staten Island and Brooklyn on one side, you know, the New York Harbor.
Well, you certainly did. That's your hometown. What a place
sure.
to come back to.
Yeah, I know. But along the, on the Brooklyn side, there was a kind of grassy bank, and they had a sign in plants, you know, all very cleverly done. And here I go. I'm going to say, the sign said, "Welcome home. Well done." I can't even. I'm sorry.
What message could have meant more to you in that moment than that? No one's ever shared that anecdote with me, and I know everyone at home is feeling the emotion of that moment for you. So many veterans, especially POWs, who learned what it felt like to live in the absence of freedom, have shared that when they did sail in, if they came into New York, that's something you sail past before you get to the port had special significance too. When you saw Lady Liberty, what did that mean to you?
It was heaven. Like coming alive again, you know. And then when we tried to dock, there were so many people, you know, the POWs on the side of the boat that was docking, because there was a lot of people, you know, waving handkerchiefs and everything. They kept announcing, "Please get away from the starboard side." Because the ship was actually listing, you know, and they couldn't dock it in the position that it was in. And, you know, we were saying, stuff it, you know.
Do you know what we've been through? We're getting off this ship.
Yeah, right.
I'll say it one more time. Do we really understand just how much we have to be thankful for as Americans? That was Ray Maloney. Find out more about him and all the other veterans you heard from today at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving, and join us again next week when we're reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.